Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. Coming to you live from east of the Appalachian Mountains. This is where the past meets the future, my friends. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are crossing the country tonight or working on your favorite project, you are about to find out more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. Now, we might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. So glad you could join us here tonight. Sorry about the sketchy intro tonight, but that's the wonder and the beauty of live radio. We've been here on the VBS Radio Network now for almost 8 years. And I appreciate the audience around the world more than you know. I also want to give a shout out to my friends at Freedom Truth Frequency Radio. I am a truth freak, just in case you didn't know that. I want you to be part of the program tonight, and you should. Our toll-free number is 888-429-5471 anywhere in North America. If you're outside of that area, you can call 530-413-9537 and get to us. Or if you're using Skype, which many of you do, you can use BBS Radio and the number 2, BBS Radio 2. Or if you need to step out, get some early Christmas shopping done, and I'm going to give you a couple of ideas for that here in just a second, you can listen on your cell phone. All you have to do is dial 805-399-1000, 805-399-1000, and then the passcode 769-608-pound. Easy enough. Lots of awesome news tonight. By the way, I want to thank the folks at the Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference in Hilversum, Holland. They did a fantastic job. Very, very professional. Very well organized. They got all the speakers from around the world to that one place in Holland, a very powerful place. We made our presentations, we made great friends, we established a marvelous energy which is still reverberating around the world from Bali to Washington State. The solar wind tonight is 352 kilometers per second, and there are 9 sunspot clusters on the sun today. I believe that's a record, or very close to it, for all the years we've been monitoring it here on this program. Barely visible when the weekend began, sunspot AR-1619 has blossomed into a large active region more than 3 times as wide as Earth, and it's pointed right at us. So far, the growing sunspot has not produced any significant flares, but the quiet is unlikely to continue if its expansion continues at the same rate. Fast-changing magnetic fields on the sun have a tendency to reconnect and erupt. NOAA forecasters estimate a 20% chance of M-class solar flares during the next 24 hours. So, sky watchers, over the next 2 or 3 days, be aware. You can always go to spaceweather.com and keep up with it in real time. Also this week, relative to the sun, there was a total eclipse of the sun this week, and it was visible by land only in Australia. People who have experienced total eclipses firsthand say the moon's shadow is one of the most amazing aspects of the experience. Its arrival causes many birds to stop singing. A hush descends on the landscape as the sky darkens and the air temperature suddenly drops. The moon's shadow lances more than a quarter million miles across the silent vacuum of space. And when it lands on Earth, it seems to bring a bit of otherworldly cold with it. If you ever get a chance to travel to a total eclipse of the sun, you should try it. And got some images relative to that that are just startling, just startling. We'll talk about it later in the program. Many people are saying that it is revealing Nibiru or Planet X or Marduk or one of the other names for this other planet or other star that's supposed to be in our solar system. I'm going to share a little bit of that with you later on in the program. How would you like to walk down the beach, just minding your own business with someone you love, and all of a sudden the beach is covered with 50,000 starfish? Yeah, starfish. We're not talking about grunion here. We're talking about starfish. You know, they're not really fast movers. They don't swim the way we would think things swim. But they somehow came ashore overnight in mass and perished on a secluded beach in Ireland. The Belfast Telegraph reports that harsh weather might have been responsible for last week's peculiar and mysterious event on Lissadel Beach. As many as 50,000 starfish scattered the beach, and experts are not sure but believe a severe storm brought them ashore. Bill Crow, a marine biologist at Sligo Institute of Technology, theorized that the starfish, also called sea stars, might have been lifted ashore while feeding on mussel beds in the nearshore tidal zone. They were spread over nearly 500 feet of coastline. The most likely explanation is that they were feeding on mussels. It's a little bit strange. None of them were attached to mussels when they were washed in, however. A toxic algae bloom would seem another possible explanation, but no other type of marine life was affected, only starfish, and mostly adult size. Equally mysterious is that virtually all the starfish were dead, meaning they had succumbed surprisingly quickly after coming or being delivered ashore. Other experts agreed that the most likely explanation is stormy weather and perhaps high surf that deposited the starfish on the beach. They turned up almost certainly as a result of the exceptional storm, said Tim Roderick, an officer with Ireland's National Park and Wildlife Service. The bizarre incident, like a smaller-scale die-off that occurred earlier this year on another beach in Ireland, does remain under investigation. You know, starfish, if you've never actually watched them in the wild, it's quite fascinating. They can live up to 35 years in the wild, and what's most interesting is that they have no brains and they have no blood. Their nervous system is spread through their arms and their blood is actually filtered seawater. They are carnivorous and they feed largely on clams, mussels, and oysters. And here's how they do it. Using tiny suction-cupped tube feet, they pry open clams or oysters, and their sac-like cardiac stomach emerges from their mouth and oozes inside the shell. Their stomach then envelopes the prey to digest it and finally withdraws back into the body. It seems unclear who collected the 50,000 dead specimens on Lissadel Beach and what became of them. As mysteriously as they appeared, they disappeared as well. No one knows what happened to the starfish. Interesting stuff, isn't it? And, you know, mankind has its effect on the wild, wherever we go. Unless, of course, you're a Boy Scout. I'll explain that to you. Ah, good grapefruit juice. In the Boy Scouts, we teach a principle called leave no trace. Now, you can go in the wild, you can observe it, You could shoot pictures of it. You can pitch a tent, make a fire, all of that. But when you leave, leave no trace. Have no effect on nature other than to observe it, which in itself is an effect, of course. But occasionally this gets out of control. And that is what has happened in the Galapagos. Once a pristine balance of amazing ecology going back as far as, early zoologists and botanists and oceanographers, going all the way back to the early proponents of evolution and writers and explorers from, the 7th or actually 18th century, 19th century, and 20th century have been all over the Galapagos. And oftentimes these ships don't take care about what they bring ashore with them. I mean, it's okay to go see the blue-footed boobies and the sea, lizards and iguanas and all kinds of different seals and sea lions and walruses and everything that propagate those islands. But the ships often bring unwanted guests. And such is the case now. And the guests have upset the ecological balance because the guests are much, much better at adapting than the indigenous species are. That's why they call it Ratmageddon. Ecuadorian authorities say the unique bird and reptile species that make the Galapagos Islands a treasure for scientists and tourists must be preserved. And that means the rats must die, hundreds of millions of them. So a helicopter is to begin dropping nearly 22 tons of specially designed rat poison bait on an island Thursday, launching the second phase of a campaign to clear out by 2020 non-native rodents from the archipelago that helped inspire Charles Darwin's theory of evolution. The invasive Norway and black rats, introduced by whalers and buccaneers beginning in the 17th century, feed on the eggs and hatchlings of the island's native species, which include giant tortoises, lava lizards, snakes, hawks, iguanas. Rats also have depleted plants on which native species feed. The rats have critically endangered bird species on the 19-island cluster 600 miles from Ecuador's coast. It's one of the worst problems the Galapagos have. Rats reproduce every 3 months and eat everything, said Juan Carlos Gonzalez, a specialist with the Nature Conservancy involved in the Phase 2 eradication operation on Pinzon Island and the islet of Plaza Sur. Now, I know what you're thinking. Wait a minute, aren't we just creating another issue? Aren't the birds going to eat the rat poison and the hawks going to eat the birds and the lizards and, you just create an eradication of all species? But phase one of the anti-rat campaign began in January of 2011 on Rabida Island, and about a dozen islets like Pinzon and Plaza Sur are also uninhabited by humans. The goal is to kill off all non-native rodents, beginning with the Galapagos' smaller islands, without endangering other wildlife. The islands where humans reside, Isabela and Santa Cruz, will come last. Previous efforts to eradicate invasive species have removed goats, cats, burros, and pigs from various islands. Pinzon is about 7 square miles, 1,812 hectares, in area, while Plaza Sur encompasses just 24 acres. This is a very expensive but totally necessary war, said Gonzalez. The rat infestation has now reached 1 per square foot. Yeah, 1 rat for every square foot on Pinzon, where an estimated 180 million rodents reside. The director of conservation for the Galapagos National Park Service, Danny Rueda, called the raticide, the largest ever in South America. The poisoned bait developed by Bell Labs in the United States is contained in light blue cubes that attract rats but are repulsive to other inhabitants of the island. The 1 centimeter cubes disintegrate in a week or so. Park official Christian Sevilla said the poison will be dropped on Pinzon and Plaza Sur through the end of November. The total of 34 hawks from Pinzon were trapped in order to protect them from eating rodents that consumed the poison. Aha, Sevilla said. They are to be released in early January. On Plaza Sur, 40 iguanas were also captured temporarily for their own protection because they also eat the rats. Asked whether a large number of decomposing rats would create an environmental problem, Rueda said the poison was specially engineered with a strong anticoagulant that will make the rats dry up and disintegrate in less than 8 days without a stench. It will help that the average temperature of the islands is 75 degrees. The current $1.8 million phase of the project is financed by the national park and nonprofit groups, including Island Conservation. The Galapagos were declared protected as a UNESCO Natural Heritage Site in 1978, and in 2007, UNESCO declared them at risk due to harm from invasive species, tourism, and immigration. So, that's how to get rid of a rat. I thought they would use a flute of some kind and just lead them into the sea, but I guess that was just a fairy tale. You know, oftentimes we have talked on this program about the fact that we are one nation under surveillance. And I've told you to, you know, be clued in. You know, keep your eyes open when you're driving out there on the freeway and around town. Excuse me while I take a sip of grapefruit juice. Sometimes when you come up to an intersection, you'll notice there's not one camera, there's six cameras. Well, they're not all looking for, you know, people running red lights. The software that goes with these cameras can read your license plate and then cross-reference it with a database. Well, first of all, to see if your license is expired or not. Second of all, to make a pattern of your travel habits. Yes, you have travel habits. And if those habits are suspicious, if you show up where you're not supposed to show up, or you show up in a place where they've been surveilling, they can follow you wherever you go, 24 hours a day, anytime you should happen to travel those roads. Yes, the cameras can see at night as well. I asked you if you had seen Highway Patrol catch up to people and pull them over on the freeway, even though you didn't see a police car or any surveillance going on as you were speeding down the freeway, hopefully doing the speed limit. And that's because the traffic cameras all along the nation's freeways now, thousands and thousands and thousands of them all over the place, can track a speeder, display its speed, take a photo of the vehicle, send it to a highway patrol car, and then that highway patrol car can catch up with you. They know it's your vehicle because they have your license number, the color of your vehicle, the model of your vehicle, and they probably took a picture of your face right through the front windshield. That's why the police don't make a mistake when they catch up to you from 8 miles behind. Well, you've seen that happen, and it's going to get worse. Some 30,000 drones are going to be flying over the country, and many of you may have seen those up there surveilling. They do it during the day and during the night. And law enforcement likes it because they don't have to pay a highway patrolman to sit out there on the side of the road and also endanger traffic, because every time you see a highway patrolman, everybody slams on their brakes, which causes a chain reaction. And sure enough, it doesn't take much of a statistician to notice that most of the traffic accidents on the freeway, when traffic is moving smoothly, are actually caused by the highway patrol being on the freeway. So you take the highway patrol off the freeway and allow traffic to move smoothly, and you avoid those fatalities, and then just use the cameras or the drones to catch those who are driving aggressively outside the law, and then just send a highway patrolman to pull over that one vehicle when it's necessary. Yes, they will get to the point where they mail you the citation, and I don't know how they're going to do that, because the way our laws are written, you have to be able to face your accuser. And obviously you can't do that if it's a surveillance camera. Lots of lawyers have tested that and have won in court. So they send a highway patrolman out there to hand deliver the arrest, which you then sign and agree to appear in court or mail them a check. And guess what? It's a great money raiser. So it's no surprise that Australia has agreed to host key U.S. space surveillance equipment, including a telescope so sophisticated it can search an area in space the size of the United States in seconds and detect a small object on the Empire State Building from as far away as Miami, Florida. Oh, yeah. Envisaged targets include space debris and Chinese space launches, a U.S. defense official told reporters after the announcement was made in Perth, Western Australia, on Wednesday. The Pentagon has expressed concern in recent years over advances in Chinese space and counter-space capabilities, particularly after Beijing in 2007, and you're going to – I don't know if you remember this or not, but this was a pretty amazing feat. Beijing in 2007 launched a ground-based ballistic missile to destroy a Chinese weather satellite in orbit, some 500 miles above the Earth. Now, we've done the same thing. Remember, we had a surveillance satellite that was launched, had super sophisticated cameras on board, and also had a lot of fuel on board. Once the satellite got up and got into orbit, it went dark. It died. Something went wrong with it. And the orbit was beginning to decay. So the Navy, rather than just let it burn up in the atmosphere and risk some of that very high-tech camera equipment surviving the fall and being recovered by someone, they shot it out of orbit. Well, the Chinese did the same thing. The successful test of an anti-satellite weapon made China just the third country after the U.S. and Soviet Union ever to have shot down an object in space. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta and his Australian counterpart Stephen Smith agreed during Australia-United States ministerial talks in Perth to relocate a space surveillance telescope from New Mexico and a U.S. Air Force C-band space surveillance radar from Antigua in the Caribbean. Now, what's interesting is both of these are expected to be based in remote northwestern Australia at a communications station that was used by the U.S. Navy during the Cold War. Panetta said the decision, along with the possible establishment of combined communications gateway in Western Australia, represented a major leap forward in bilateral space cooperation and an important new frontier in the United States rebalance of the Asia-Pacific region. Now, the interesting thing is that you got to think about the fact that they're putting both of these telescopes in northwestern Australia. Why is that important? Well, we're going to cover this in more detail later on in the program. But I can tell you that Western Australia is going to be tectonically unstable in the next few years. There is a possibility that Western Australia and Eastern Australia are going to split, and only Eastern Australia will be habitable. I'll just let that sink in for a second. So if we're putting our eggs in the northwestern basket of Australia, it's a possibility they need to rethink that, because we're going to be blind if they put it there. We recognize the need to address the rising threat presented by increasing congestion in space from over 50 years of space activities and a significant rise in space debris, an Osman communique stated. In particular, we need to ensure our continued access to space assets for services critical to the functioning of a modern economy, as well as for national security purposes. I would suppose that will be weather, television, and GPS, along with numerous surveillance satellites. The C-band radar will track space assets and debris in low Earth orbit and increase the coverage of space objects in the southern hemisphere. Do you find it peculiar, since these satellites, you know, obviously orbit the Earth, with the exception of the geosynchronous satellites, do you think it's significant that this special high-resolution C-band radar satellite telescope, or I'm sorry, telescope looking into space, is placed in the southern hemisphere? I thought so. I know you have thoughts on it. 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471. I knew you would pick up on that right away, because there seems to be something going on in the southern hemisphere. There seems to be something that NASA knows about, that the NSA knows about, that those who are running the observatory in Antarctica know about, but nobody in the northern hemisphere knows about yet. So it would make sense that some kind of telescope that's able to look at something the size of a baseball in orbit in an area the size of the United States in space within seconds. After you track all the space debris, you know exactly where it's going to go. There are software programs and computer programs that are computer systems that track all that stuff. We know when it's getting close to the International Space Station. We know what orbit it's on. We know what track it's on. We can watch pretty much everything. So why would you have to monitor it? Exactly. You got it. Because something new could be entering that space. And it might not be from around here. The Space Surveillance Telescope will provide enhanced capability detecting and tracking of objects in what are known as geosynchronous orbits, some 22,000 miles above Earth's surface. It'll also be able to track all the loose stuff and, well, shall we say, things that change course in space. The agency said in a statement, the 180,000-pound telescope will track and catalog space debris and objects unique to the space in that region of the world that could threaten Department of Defense satellites. The system is capable of detecting a small laser pointer on top of New York City's Empire State Building from a distance equal to Miami, Florida. How about that? These features combine to provide orders of magnitude improvements in field of view and scanning for deep space surveillance. Deep space surveillance. Now, for those of you that don't know what that means well outside our orbit. Got that? The data captured by the telescope will be fed into a worldwide U.S. Air Force network that observes and catalogs space objects and warns on possible collisions between them. Data on small asteroid detection will also be provided to NASA and the scientific community. So we have a new friend in the near-Earth object detection business. Maybe they got tired of being shown up by all the amateurs with very good telescopic equipment, great digital cameras that oversample each night as they photograph these things in the same, you know, few degrees of space and notice when things are moving and are responsible for letting us know about all of the asteroids, meteorites, oh, yes, and comets that enter our space. It's not the government telescopes that are finding this stuff. It's amateurs. So I guess It was about time that they had an early warning system on several different scales of thought. The idea is that the Pacific is big enough for all of us. Part of the new defense strategy that Australia's foreign minister, Bob Carr, says, we've made clear that one of our key focuses is to rebalance to the Pacific. Now, Panetta told a joint briefing, we simply would not be able to do that effectively without allies like Australia. In line with an agreement reached between the two countries last year, from the middle of this year, Australia's Northern Territory began hosting 250 U.S. Marines for six-month rotations for training and as a base for humanitarian and military operations in the region. The number will gradually build up to 2,500 Marines by the year 2016. Smith said during the press briefing, the two sides have also begun discussions on further U.S. access to Northern Territory airfields and possibly U.S. naval access to Australia's Indian Ocean naval port near Perth. So I guess it's no surprise that one of the Pacific bases, which we used during the Cold War, and we are now, because of budget cutbacks, getting ready to abandon. It has a 10,800-foot runway. It's no surprise that China landed an official on that island this week, and they took a four-hour tour, actually four-and-a-half-hour tour of the island, and they're thinking of taking over the airbase as the U.S. Air Force withdraws. It's strategic. It kind of cuts off the Pacific, you know. They could secure those air routes and even ocean routes if they were to put the right equipment on that island. The Pentagon has warned that China's expanding space program over the past decade includes capabilities with potentially hostile military applications. May of this year, in a report to Congress on Chinese military power, the Department of Defense reported that China is expanding its space-based surveillance, reconnaissance, navigation, meteorological, and communication satellite constellations, as well as putting up their own space station. As China continues to develop its space launch payload capabilities, it has also developed a multidimensional program to limit or deny the use of space-based assets by adversaries during times of crisis or conflict. In addition to the direct ascent anti-satellite weapon tested in 2007, these counter space capabilities also include jamming, laser, microwave, and also cyber weapons. Over the past 2 years, China has also conducted increasingly complex close proximity operations between satellites while offering little in the way of transparency or explanation. Yeah, we see that all the time in American industry, folks, just in case you're thinking about contracting with the Chinese to build something for you. The Chinese Communist Party affiliate Global Times on Thursday cited Chinese experts as saying the stepped-up U.S.-Australia cooperation would pose no actual threat to China, considering the country's modernized national defense forces. Distracted by the crisis in the Middle East and domestic budget pressures, the U.S. is seeking allies' help to jointly contain China, a researcher said with the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences Institute of American Studies. Xu Gangyu, a senior researcher at China Arms Control and Disarmament Association, how would you like to be the chief operating officer of that corporation in the U.S.? Yeah, the China Arms Control and Disarmament Association told the newspaper that China is able to take countermeasures if the monitoring interferes with our space activities. If the radar and telescope deployment enables the U.S. to monitor the orbit and speed of Chinese rockets and missiles, Xu said, confidential information relating to guidance systems will remain concealed. He says, it is a violation of the fundamental principle of non-contradiction in that something cannot be and not be at the same time in the same respect. To express a concern about the military capabilities of communist states while currently hollowing out our own military by unilaterally disarming them both materially and morally under the same leadership of individuals whose resumes are proof positive that they despise our military, which defines the sham Obama administration that never met an American military capability critical to the defense that couldn't be negotiated away. That is why Putin is on record of being delighted with Comrade Obama's reelection, and he understands that any concern professed by Obama for America's national security is feigned, given that the Manchurian candidate Obama is destroying America's economy, which puts America's defense in grave peril. That's a quote, people. I didn't make that up. You know, sometimes we put people up on pedestals. We put organizations up on pedestals. We've always had great respect for the U.S. Secret Service. They have a couple of jobs. One is to protect presidents and presidential candidates, and the other is to secure the currency in the United States. Yeah, counterfeiters, all kind of stuff like that. And we've always thought of them as the individuals who would throw themselves in front of a bullet, that they're fearless, that they're, you know, incorruptible. Somehow they're cut above. Somehow they're the dark suit that could be trusted. And yet lately we've seen their integrity in question. We've seen the Secret Service embroiled in sex scandals. I mean, who doesn't pay a prostitute? Come on. If you're going to go to a foreign country and you work for the U.S. Secret Service, you'd think that you would go with enough cash to be able to pay your prostitute. Evidently, they didn't do that. It got them in a lot of trouble. And, you know, well, one thing leads to another. You know, hell hath no fury like blah, 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 blah. Okay. Well, Thai officials reassure the U.S. Secret Service, sort of like, you know, holding their hand, patting them, you know, on the top of their heads and saying, look, it's okay, it's okay. Reassured the Secret Service that lizards found on Government House grounds were not the dangerous Komodo dragons, but water lizards. Yeah, the U.S. Secret Service team mistook the relatively benign water monitors for the carnivorous Komodo dragons as the team conducted security inspections of the Government House Thursday ahead of President Obama's visit that begins today, the Bangkok Post reported. Yeah, so meanwhile, a U.S. explosives team reported five locations Obama will visit during his two-day visit to Thailand have been thoroughly scanned. Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra security detail was also planning and rehearsing for a reception for the U.S. president. He's in Thailand today. The United States is interested in establishing a humanitarian and disaster relief force at Utapeo, a naval and air force complex on the eastern seaboard built by the U.S. military during the Vietnam War. The return to Utapeo would be very symbolic for the U.S., sending a message to China that it is returning to mainland Southeast Asia. And I'm going to try to get this word right. Panitan Watanayagam, a military affairs expert at Chulalongkorn University, told the Post. Such a move would require approval by Thai lawmakers, some of whom are skeptical about the U.S. military being permanently based in Thailand again. The U.S. officials have announced plans to focus more on the Asia-Pacific region in military, cultural, and development areas. Well, I would think that would be right, you know, after pouring so much money into the U.S. presidential election – it's only fair that we would, you know, reciprocate by putting some assets in the area. Makes a nice way to flow American taxpayer money back into their economy. It's only right, after all. While things like that are going on here on Earth, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in the next hour, I'm sure most of you heard that the sun unleashed a monster eruption of superhot plasma a couple of days ago on Friday in back-to-back solar storms, and they were captured on camera by the SDO, the Solar Dynamics Observatory. The giant sun eruption, it's also called a solar prominence, occurred at 1 a.m. Eastern Time, with another event flaring up a few hours later. Now, the prominences were so large that they expanded beyond the camera view of the satellite, which captured high-definition images of it and video. In the video, a colossal loop of glowing red plasma erupted from the lower left of the sun, arcing up and out of frame as it blasts away from the star. Now, that's not aimed right at us. The red glowing looped material is plasma, which is a hot gas made of electrically charged hydrogen and helium. Officials with NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, which oversees the SDO mission, explained in a description. The prominence plasma flows along a tangled and twisted structure of magnetic fields generated by the sun's internal dynamo. An erupting prominence occurs when such a structure becomes unstable and it bursts outward, releasing the plasma. It's really quite fascinating. Friday's solar eruption does not appear to be aimed at Earth, but remember, there are 9 sunspot clusters facing Earth right now. But this one will likely have any effect on Earth. It was an M6, which is moderate, but tolerable. Tuesday and Wednesday of last week, there were a geomagnetic storm that supercharged the Earth's auroras, which created really spectacular northern lights displays for observers at high latitudes, green and red, just rare combinations of colors. Now the sunspots are aimed directly at Earth, so anything that they shoot off today or tomorrow is going to strike us directly. In other news, we just have a little bit left in this hour. If you want to call in with any kind of news reports of your own, or if any of this gets controversial enough that you're ready to talk about it, the number here is 888-429-5471, anywhere in North America. Anywhere outside of North America, it's 530-413-9537. I want to talk a little bit about the Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference that took place in Hilversum, Holland, because there was a couple of really amazing combinations and presentations that were made there, not just the Breakthrough Energy technology, you know, different kinds of oscillators and transducers, energy treatment systems that will gather energy in one form and convert it to another form more useful to us. That was certainly cool, and there was a lot of great technology that was shared with us. The frustrating thing is that none of the technology was really in prototype form. It was in, I'm going to call it proof of concept form, a piece here, a piece there. You could clearly see, though, that with the right manufacturing capabilities, microchip making capabilities, machining capabilities, magnetic programming capabilities, that these technologies could work and would work in a commercially viable way. That is to say, mass manufacturing to get it into the consumer level. And all kinds of niches, and we discussed those. The frustrating thing is that there was no funding anywhere on the planet to make this happen. And so what was proposed was forming what we called the Global Energy Freedom Fund. One of the things that was discussed in a presentation was the NERC, which is the National Electrical Reliability Corporation, I know. You don't pay them a bill. You don't even know who they are, more than likely. But they're a private corporation that does a government function. What they do is they coordinate all the electrical utility companies in the United States. And in Europe, there's another organization, which is called Eurocrit. Now, what these organizations do is they not only coordinate the frequency. In this country, we use 60 cycles per second. They coordinate the frequency to within literally a hundredth of a wavelength as tightly as possible, because if the frequency gets off from one utility to another, then the waves become destructively interfering out there on the grid, and you end up losing energy, creating heat, and basically it's like dragging your foot while going down the highway. But it also centralizes the control over the grid. That is to say, the half a dozen main development districts, there are about 9 total districts in the United States, are all tied together under one central control system. Now, obviously, grouping these control systems together is sort of like putting all your eggs in one basket. Yes, I appreciate that. But it also creates a series of vulnerabilities. And recently, the NERC had a meeting in which they discussed these vulnerabilities, and they came up with 3 main areas. The first is pandemic. I know what you're thinking. What the heck does a pandemic have to do with electricity? But it does. Because with a pandemic, you have regions of the country, or even regions of the world, where people get sick. And sometimes they get sick and die. Well, these are the people that know how to do stuff. They know how to switch things on and off. They know how to run these nuclear reactors. They know how to run the switchgear, the substations. They know how to monitor things. They have skill sets that are well beyond, the average lineman. If they get sick and die in one region, it needs to be possible to not only monitor but also take control of that local grid from another location. And so that's one of the things that they're thinking about. If we have a pandemic and people get sick, humans with those kinds of skill sets are integral parts of the grid. And so it has to be a contingency plan has to be made for it. Well, you know what would do. They would just create a remote control kind of capability, right? Well, the fact that cyber connectivity is created, and of course it's got to be practiced with. So how you do it is also has to be tested and retested. It has to be tested under stress, under high load conditions, under terrible weather conditions. And those tests are being designed as we speak. They haven't undergone them yet, but those tests are going, the design of them, experiments are being designed as we speak. But it creates the second vulnerability, which is a vulnerability to attack, either physical or cyber, which means, armed people could move in on a power grid and take control of it and thus disrupt the service to a key area, maybe areas that are feeding a military base that is key to the battlefield, or seaports, or command and control. Obviously, if all the cell phones go down, and all of the traffic lights go down, and all the gas pumps go down, it can pretty much immobilize even the best emergency operations. The second level of that, of course, is the cyber attack, which they have already done. They've done it. The Chinese have done it. The Russians have done it. The Iranians have done it. And we detect that from time to time, and we're every single day building countermeasures to it. In fact, the people that write the countermeasures are the people that write the viruses. We already know about the Stuxnet virus. We know that the United States was involved in writing the Stuxnet virus and implementing the Stuxnet virus. We even know the name of the company that was doing it, Symantec. What, that doesn't ring a bell for you? Okay, how about this? Norton Antivirus. Yeah, those are the guys that wrote the software, at least our part of it, and implemented it. So the antivirus guys are the virus guys, which of course, makes total sense to you and me. But, we tried to keep it secret, but, some civilians have their hands in their pockets instead of over their mouths when there's a microphone around, and so now everyone knows. But the problem is that we now have this capability because the power grids are being centralized into one group, one room, one command and control center. And the third one, and I'm really surprised that they're starting to pick up on this and really putting some emphasis on it, and they did so in this wonderful 122-page report that I read. All of the major signers, Duke Energy, PP&G, Avista, TVA, all the major utilities signed on to this. The third one is natural disasters, including EMPs from solar activity. Yeah, so, and I'll explain that to you just a little bit. The threat for that comes because you know the way the power is generated. They generate, let's just say, for example, 161 kilowatts. That's what's generated in Middle Tennessee. That's what you see on the high-tension lines, the big aluminum lines that are up on the really, really big towers, you know, the ones that clear the trees and this, you know, traverses hundreds of miles of countryside. The big aluminum lines sit up on insulators, and they carry 161,000 volts at a fair amount of current. That arrives at a substation, and what the substation does is it grabs that 161,000 volts and steps it down in voltage using a step-down transformer. Usually they're auto-tap transformers because the end voltage has to be controlled pretty well, usually plus or minus 5% or less. The supply voltage can drift quite a bit. Depends on how much water is going over the dam or how fast the turbines are spinning. You get the picture. The frequency, dead on the money. The voltage can drift. So the auto-tap transformer can select different coil lengths in the transformer to keep the output voltage the same. So they step the voltage down from 161,000 volts down to 13,800 volts. You'll get the math here in a second. From there, it goes to a series of switchgear and step-down transformers and steps it down to 4,160. We call it 4160. That 4160 goes out into the area and is cut down to 440 and then 220 up on the little pole mount or pad mount transformers that you see in your neighborhood, and it comes directly into your house as 220. One of those legs is 110 or 120, which is what you use for your TV and the computer that you're listening to this program on, and the 220 runs your stove and your water heater and your heat pump. And that's the way the grid works. That's the way the grid works when the power comes from the power station out to your television or your light switch, or your water pump. But with a solar EMP, you have maybe 10 million volts that are thrown onto this gigantic antenna, which we've stretched all over the country now, which we call the grid. I'm not talking about the primary lines. I'm talking about the secondary lines. All the hundreds of thousands of miles of telephone poles and wires that are stretched all over the country. If you don't believe me, just take a look at a night shot of the United States or Europe. You'll see what I'm talking about. That is all wires that make up a giant antenna, a whole continent-size antenna. And what happens is the voltage goes on that line, and it doesn't go into your house. It goes backwards to the step-down transformer, which now going in that direction is a step-up transformer. And so the 10 million volts gets jacked up to about 2 billion volts, and that goes back to the power station. Well, it's not going to get into the power station, so what do you think happens? The two weakest links melt down. One is that giant 13,800-volt auto-tap transformer in the substation. The core melts. You saw it happen just the other night in New Jersey. That giant explosion was a substation step-down transformer. It'll be 2 to 3 years before that transformer is replaced. Why? Because they're so expensive, we don't have any inventory. You ever try to order anything lately? Have you been to Walmart where the shelf is empty and you've gone to the manager and say, hey, you got any more of these in my size? No. What we have is on the shelf. It'll be next year before we get that tennis shoe in your size. That's what I'm talking about. There's no money for inventory. Thousands upon thousands of manufacturers are suffering under the same kind of economization. Car dealers, car manufacturers, truck manufacturers, battery manufacturers, electric motor manufacturers, there is no inventory on the shelf. It isn't on the shelf for two reasons. Number one, the company doesn't have enough money to put into inventory to sit on the shelf and wait for you to make an order. And number two, the IRS taxes those businesses terribly on the amount of inventory that's left on the shelf come December 31st. Why do you think everything goes on sale right before the end of the year? Because those stores don't want anything, nothing on their shelves come December 31st. They're taxed on the inventory that's left on the shelves and carries over to the next year. Now you see why we don't have any more of those auto-tap transformers sitting in warehouses around this country. When they melt down, and they most assuredly will melt down in the case of a giant EMP from the sun like we had in 1859, the Carrington event, we saw it happen again in 1989 in the Northeast with the Quebec grid going down. And then we've had two really interesting trial events, Katrina in 2007 and now Sandy in 2012. We didn't do so good, either one of those. We didn't do very well either time. There are still areas of one of the most populous and advanced areas in the world. It's still dark. There are high-rises in New Jersey and New York that still don't have power. They still don't have running water. None of the switching is working. None of the lights work. None of the heat works. It isn't a good time of year for this to happen. And that was just a little tiny issue. Yeah, it was a superstorm, but come on. It was super with a little S. Less than 100-mile-an-hour winds, less than a 15-foot swell. I think it was 11 feet. That's nothing. The low-lying areas that always get hit got hit. Nothing new there, folks. Nothing new. By the time they pour $4 billion worth of insurance money in there, in the 36 months, you won't even know what ever happened. And, yes, people that live in those low-lying areas will build their houses right back in the low-lying area, just like they have done, you know, for over the last 50 years. And many of those homes have been rebuilt many times over the same period of time. And I'm always amazed, as much as we talk about on this program, to get some food storage together, to get some water storage together, to get some safety net put together, that within 24 hours of something like that happening, the first people in the streets are them. Where's my cookies and cocoa? Where's my blanket? Where's my bottled water? It's just amazing. I know none of you are in that shape. Let's take a quick break. We'll be right back at the top of the hour with more X Squared Radio. We'll be right back after this.
Thank you. never fall away.
Squared Radio, coming to you live from east of the Appalachian Mountains. Our AccuWindow window forecast is 54 degrees and clear. As I was talking about this in the last hour, it reminded me that I need to tell you that you have some options as you're getting ready to buy for your loved ones and your neighbors for Christmas. Instead of buying that expensive electronic gift this year or something else, I would recommend an investment. I would recommend going to X Squared Radio at x2-radio.com and check out our affiliate right at the top on the right-hand side, the Food Investor. This is a way to really show the person that you love that you care about them. We just watched millions of people in the Northeast hit the streets because they did not prepare, because nobody loved them enough to prepare them for this. Oh, we told them on the news, get out, go to the store, buy an extra few cans of beans or whatever. But you could see the people that went into the streets from these high-rises and apartments and condos and houses, they didn't have any food. They had a one-day supply of food. Their TV dinners melted and became, you know, inedible as soon as the power went out, because that's where they stored their stuff in their refrigerator. Well, what I'm talking about is a delicious food that's made by my good friends, Scott Barzee and Danny Morris out there in Utah, that will keep for 30 years with no preservatives. They've discovered the way to do it. They've discovered the way to capture the flavor in the food and the nutrition in the food, and it's lightweight. It comes in easy to carry, easy to pack, easy to carry, or easy to store foil packs that will keep for 30 years. Everything's labeled on the outside. You can go to the Food Investor by going to x2-radio.com and pick up a 72-hour kit for your loved one. Now that will really deliver. And when this does happen, and yes, I did say when, not if. Yeah, it's nice to own this stuff and never need it. But if you need it, I'm saying as sooner or later, you're going to. In the next 30 years, this is something you can hand down. It's something you can inherit. Food. And probably the IRS isn't going to get a hold of it either. I mean, how much do they know what a chicken casserole is worth? Check it out. The Food Investor, X Squared Radio at x2-radio.com. By the way, a lot of you have taken advantage of that. I'm getting the notices from the affiliate that these sales are taking place. And all positive comments. Fast shipping, good packaging, and delicious flavor. So this is the way to do it. You know, we've been shopping for a long, long time for an affiliate that could deliver emergency preparedness stuff to our listeners. And yes, we've gone through a few, but nothing like this. And I mean nothing like this on several levels. The flavor, the quality, and the fact that they actually pay the radio station to advertise is kind of nice. You know, none of the other ones, all the ones that came through Commission Junction, all that, they never paid. And, you know, we'll do stuff for free for a while just as a public service. But if you don't pay, you don't keep up with the agreement that you made, then we're going to throw you out. And the guys at Food Investor have really, really done the job. And they're doing a great job on all levels. So check them out. Now, as I described to you, this NERC, which is the National Electrical Reliability Corporation, it has worked on this plan to centralize the grid. You know what the grid is, right? Just walk outside your house, you'll see a green pad mount transformer in your yard, or you'll see a gray one up on the pole. That's your connection to the grid, that meter that spins whenever you flip the lights on or turn the stove on or your air conditioner or heat pump kicks on. That's the grid. If it goes out, it goes dark, your cell phone charge runs out, you're pretty much off grid. You're pretty much disconnected. Think about it. That's our connection to civilization. You can't get gasoline, you can't get food, you can't get heat or information, and you can't pump water into your house. And I don't even think your natural gas system will work because it works off an electric igniter. So all of that is dependent upon the power grid. So what came out of this Breakthrough Energy Movement conference is that there is a need, while they're going to spend, say, $200 billion over the next 5 to 8 years to centralize this grid and, of course, put the safeguards in place so that those three areas of vulnerability that now become evident, the pandemic, the cyber and physical attack on the system, and the natural disaster, which can occur rather unexpectedly sometimes, especially solar EMPs, can be offset by taking 0.5% of the money. Yeah, they can keep 99.5% of the money. No problem. Go ahead, centralize your grid. Take 0.5% of the money, $1 billion, and create a global energy freedom fund. What this fund is used for specifically is to take technology from the concept stage through the prototype stage and get it ready for manufacturing. You see, that funding is missing from the picture. And I'd like to say there are probably a dozen or maybe two dozen great technologies out there that need funds to get from the garage or the basement or the attic or the shop, you know, out in back of the house to the manufacturing line and to the consumer. And I would say hundreds of inventors are out there with great ideas and they can't get to the manufacturer because there's no funds to do it. There's no money for motors and wires and circuits and testing and special machining and magnetic programming. I mean magnetic programming, magnets that the series of the flux field is programmed in the making of the magnet. You didn't know that could be done, did you? Oh, you wouldn't believe the effects you can get when you do that. They can act as springs. They can act as like magnetic Velcro. It's amazing the applications that they can do with these programmed magnets. It's really phenomenal. You didn't know about it because they're not being manufactured. You got to go to a Breakthrough Energy conference to see that kind of stuff. Why? Because there are no funds to get it from the concept stage through the prototype stage and into manufacturing. That's what the Global Energy Freedom Fund is for. Now, admittedly, this is a future concept. We're back now in the past, in 2012, thinking about a way to decentralize the grid. So while 99.5% of the money is being used to centralize the control of the grid and the origination and the command of the grid, why not spend 0.5% to decentralize the grid so that when that grid goes down, and I don't mean if, I mean when, somebody threw a wrong switch in Yuma, Arizona, and El Toro Marine Base went dark for 8 hours. I'm sorry, folks. That's just not acceptable in the 21st century. Especially when the technology to keep that Marine Base's essential services running for 2 or 3 days without so much as an outside electron. It exists right now, but not at that Marine Base. Why? Because there's no money in the system to decentralize that grid. All the money is there to centralize the grid. And that is not only a national security risk, it's a state risk, it's a community risk, and people die because of it. They die because of it. It's stupid to not take this great technology and get it into the marketplace, and this is how it's done. Now, we down at Phoenix Science Foundation will try to spearhead that, but, you know, our funds are limited as well, basically because it comes out of my paycheck and a few donations that you have generously given over the years. Hey, $10 here, $20 there, believe me, it makes a difference. It makes a huge difference. We're able to create awareness. We're able to go out and lecture and create a situation in these communities around the world where they know what technology is available. They know how to get a hold of the inventor. They know how to provide him funds. They know how to provide him resources such as a building or a lab or a tool or a manufacturer, a contract manufacturer. That comes because of your donations. That's what we do with the money. Nobody gets a salary. We don't pay a single person. Everybody in that corporation is a volunteer. So you go to phoenixsciencefoundation.org and you hit that donate button, you know that it's going to a good cause. Now, you know, it's not tax deductible. I'm sorry. We just didn't set up as a 501c3. We're going to go to Washington. We're going to talk to congressmen. We're going to talk to senators. And we're going to try to convince them of this. So we don't want to do a 501c3 because we're not eligible to do those kinds of activities. Yeah, you didn't know that, did you? If you're a nonprofit, you better not be going to Washington and talking to people on behalf of your organization, because that's called lobbying, and your 501c3 will be stripped from you. We don't take in that much money. We don't sell anything. We don't earn any income of any kind. So it's just not necessary. We don't need to do that. But I will tell you that the IRS will be more than happy to have you waive all of your rights to privacy, your right to the Fifth Amendment, every time you sign that 1040 every April 15th. And they're going to take what they want from your wages. You got to give that up. And of course, you know they're not going to spend that money where you want it spent. But you don't have any power over that. So the way I look at it is, they're going to take your money and spend it the way they want to. You have no choice over the matter. But you do have some choice to tax yourself. Yeah. I mean, you can tax yourself. You can say, I'm going to give $20 a month to Phoenix Science Foundation. And if a million of you did it, we'd have the money to establish this fund, put the structure in place, whether it be in Singapore or Ireland or wherever it has to be, and we could start putting this fund together. As the United States spends $200 billion to centralize its grid, we can make them, or at least convince them, to carve 0.5% of that money out, stick it in the fund, and let us begin funding some of this breakthrough technology. They're not going to do it. You know that. If they did it, they'd keep it to themselves, and you'll never see it. But if there's a possibility that we could convince them globally, Europe, South Africa, China, South America, Canada, Mexico, the U.S., to contribute to this fund, we can get some of this breakthrough technology to you, to the consumer. You know what the greatest source of disease in the world is? It's lack of refrigeration. It's lack of refrigeration. It's keeping milk cold, keeping food cold, keeping medicines cold. And there's technology out there right now that can make standalone refrigerators that you don't have to plug in. Standalone refrigerators and freezers that will stay cold indefinitely. Well, as long as you don't leave the door open, they'll stay cold indefinitely. And you could put it in the middle of the desert, stick it in the sand, close the door, turn it on, and it gets cold. And there's not a power source for 100 miles in any direction. That technology exists today, but you can't buy that refrigerator. You can't buy that refrigerator because there's a disconnect between who created the technology and who needs it as the end user. And that's what this fund will fix. Can we do it with $20 donations? Maybe. Maybe we can. One thing's for sure. It can't be done without it. So if you want to donate, donate. You don't want to donate, that's fine. Just wait around and, rub two sticks together to make fire. I'm just telling you, it's here now, and we can do it. You know, a lot of people are afraid of spiders. I would say that there are some new people that are afraid of spiders. Yes, unbelievable that in Guwahati, India, officials say colonies of giant biting spiders have attacked villagers and sparked panic in remote northeast India. I'm not kidding, folks. These spiders are big enough to take on with a baseball bat. They say locals' attempts to treat painful swelling caused by the bites may be more dangerous than the spiders themselves. Two bite victims have died already in Tinsukia district. Authorities say it is unclear whether they died from venom or from treatment by witch doctors who cut them with razor blades to drain the wounds. Local magistrate Kishore Thakuria said the victims were cremated before autopsies could be done. Another 7 bite victims have been treated with antibiotics against infection after they also tried to drain their wounds. Evidently, this bite is really nasty. The hairy spiders were first noticed about a month ago across Tinsukia District's grassy plains and dense jungle forests north of Brahmaputra River. Ecologist L.R. Sakia at Assam's Dibrugarh University said it may be a previously unknown species of tarantula. It looks like a new species. We haven't been able to identify it, he said Tuesday. Officials cannot use anti-venom in treating bite victims until the species is identified. Meanwhile, villagers are keeping lamps on at night and standing guard against spiders entering their mud and thatch huts. There are about 100,000 villagers, mostly poor rice farmers, living in the area cut off from roads by the river. Officials say the spiders are now showing up south of the Brahmaputra River. Man, if you ever were scared of spiders, that's pretty frightening stuff right there. I'm sorry. I think I would probably be afraid of spiders if I had something like that show up. That's just really scary stuff. There is more doom and gloom and despair growing in the Northeast in the weeks after the superstorm Sandy, with thousands of New Yorkers and New Jersey residents still reeling from the loss of their homes and power. People don't really know what to do about it. Things are dark, they're cold. For many, the despair has grown into an intense anger at who? I have no idea. I mean, you could be angry at God, I guess. They should be angry at their own lack of preparedness, although some people did lose their homes, but I'm not talking about those people. I'm talking about the people that are running up and down the streets going, hey, you know, where's my 5 gallons of free gas? Where's my blanket? Where's my cookies and cocoa? Who's going to take care of me? But tent cities are being set up by the FEMA, and they begin to resemble, well, prison camps. Moreover, the aftermath of Sandy is a story the mainstream media, for some reason, well, they're not covering it. They're just not. I can tell you from my experience with Katrina that it is a phenomenal difference between the way Katrina was treated and the way this storm is being treated. It's really something. Katrina, I was in Dallas-Fort Worth when Katrina hit, and we had the most unbelievable influx of refugees, I'm going to call them, just people pouring out of Louisiana and Mississippi up into Fort Worth. They came in by the busloads. And these people had lost everything. They lost their homes, the clothes on their back, everything, and they were given some money and put up for a while there. And then Hattiesburg, Mississippi, you know, probably doubled in size and still remains pretty big to this day, because people came to Hattiesburg and then they stayed. And it's been good for the city, and they just didn't rebuild the areas back down by the coast. But it's true, a lot of people fell through the cracks, but you know, they were generally poor and mostly unemployed, and you know, who knows, you know, what kind of hardships they had in their own lives. But the point is that the Northeast isn't that way. We're talking about people that were gainfully employed, they're homeowners, they own businesses, they work for companies, and for some reason the story just is not being told. The press isn't going up and down the streets, you know, doing human interest stories the way they were doing it after Katrina. So a lot of people are falling through the cracks. And some of these big camps, like one that's called Camp Freedom, ironically enough, but no one there feels very free or very secure or very comfortable. There were Black Hawk helicopters flying all day and all night. They have heavy equipment moving past everyone. You know, they have to try to relax and get some rest, but, you know, everything's a lot of heavy equipment moving around, and it's not the kind of equipment that you would think. I mean, jeeps and military equipment, and it's beginning to look a little bit like a, you know, like a POW camp. I don't know how to describe it any other way. And the frustration is growing because people are not seeing the kind of progress that they thought they would see. Bulldozers coming and clearing out streets, trash being collected, all the, you know, debris and stuff being collected you know, much the same it would be after a tornado or something like that. That just doesn't seem to be happening. And they're not seeing the kind of support from the federal government that they thought they were going to see. The state government is frustrated. They don't have the resources to take care of something like this. And generally speaking, the people were not very well prepared. And, you know, they also stopped the camp dwellers from taking pictures. They also cut off their Wi-Fi, told them, you know, basically, we don't want you posting pictures of this on Facebook. So just, you know, stay here and we'll take care of everything. Don't worry about anything. And it's cold and it looks like they may be there till spring. Babies are being born. People are dying of exposure, those kinds of things. That's the kind of lack of preparedness that we had on an individual basis up in the Northeast. Now, there are other interesting phenomena happening, and I know you haven't heard about this because it was a really strange story, a strange phenomenon. A lot of you know what the New Madrid Fault is, right? You know that it goes from somewhere around Louisiana all the way up into North Dakota. It has been known to have some pretty violent earthquakes. In the early 1800s, I believe it was 1830 or 1836, there was a terrible earthquake along the New Madrid Fault. It was so bad that the Mississippi River ran backwards and it formed Real Foot Lake, which is still there today. Now, since then, the New Madrid Fault has, you know, had little rumblings here and there, but nothing like that. And, of course, the Mississippi has how many dams on it? Well, a lot. The Mississippi River, the power of the Mississippi River is used to move millions of tons of freight up and down that river. It is also used to generate electricity for dozens of cities. So it's a lifeline down the center of the country. It's often been said that if the Mississippi River were to drop all the bridges that cross it, basically you have every east-west interstate, I-40, you know, I-70, I-80, you know, 64. Well, yes, of course, they're all the even-numbered ones. They cross the Mississippi, and if the bridges where those interstates cross the Mississippi were to drop, it would literally cut the country in half. And so this report is quite amazing because it seems as though the New Madrid Fault Zone is under a methane gas attack. No, not that kind of methane gas, not like, you know, at a Mexican restaurant methane gas. From the Louisiana sinkhole and the Gulf of Mexico, according to the Examiner's Deborah Dupree, natural methane gas leaks in Louisiana now number 28. Methane gas leaks are spreading throughout the South Louisiana area. Within 4 months, as of this week, methane bubbling sites have increased to 28, and we also learn that methane is the mysterious, powerful underground force wreaking this kind of havoc. Meanwhile, we've had at least 6 mysterious explosions within the last month within the New Madrid Fault Zone from Louisiana through northern Indiana, and a continuing cover-up in Louisiana over what is really going on. Well, I do have a video link I'm going to play here in just a second, but the first explosion occurred on November 7th at about 8 p.m. in Shelby County, Indiana. Pieces of a log home litter a country yard in Shelby County after an explosion happened on the 5700 block of 1100 North. Deputies received a call for help at the home just before 11 p.m. on Tuesday. I'm going to play the clip for you now, and we'll see how it goes.
Steve, look at what's left here. A home explosion threw family members from a house. rural Shelby County, and now all four of those people are hospitalized. It happened just a couple miles south of New Pal late last night. 24-Hour News 8's Julian Grace is live in Shelby County tonight. And Julian, let's start with how the victims are tonight.
Well, Eric, we really don't know. We do not have a condition on the four victims. However, we are learning more about the home in question. It used to stand right there, but no longer. Now it's just a pile of wood. Earlier today, we talked to a neighbor who talked to one of the homeowners shortly before the blast. That homeowner told his neighbor that he smelled smoke. Later that night, the explosion happened.
And then just like a bomb went off.
Smoldering rubble marks the spot of a home explosion that nearly took four lives. Two men and two women were inside when the home blew up.
Two in the basement. They came up these stairs right here.
Found the other two in the front yard by that corral, about 75 feet away from the house.
One person was airlifted to Methodist. The other three were rushed to the same hospital by ambulance.
I was just sick about it. And I, you know, anybody that gets hurt like this, it's, you don't know what to do.
What caused the explosion remains unknown, but neighbors say that propane tank was filled earlier on Tuesday. Several hours later, you have this explosion.
It's shocking. I mean, when you wake up in the morning, you never think about something like this happening. You know, you think it's just another day, but it's just amazing how anything can happen, I guess.
Firefighters gave no timetable for when their investigation will wrap up. On Wednesday afternoon, neighbors drove by to sneak a peek of the home that once stood, but is no more.
I am in shock. I don't, you know, I have no idea how it happened.
In addition to having that propane tank filled, we're also told by neighbors that the homeowners had the furnace worked on earlier this week. Now, once again, investigators are not saying what caused this fire just yet or this explosion. They say they are still investigating. Eric?
Are you still seeing people driving by just to get a look at the wreckage?
Eric, that has been constant. We've constantly seen neighbors driving up and down this street trying to get a peek at the explosion or what's left of the home. Also, I can tell you that investigators have been on the scene. They are still combing through the rubble, trying to figure out exactly what caused the blast.
Well, I've seen this happen before in the town of Bowling Green, Kentucky. A gas leak got out of control, blew up the house. There were two individuals sitting on the couch in the living room. The blast lifted the roof off of the house. The third individual was standing at the back door, and it blew him out the back door and across the yard. Believe it or not, none of the three were seriously injured. Just completely blew the house apart, though. Now, I guess what they're trying to imply from this story is that it's along the New Madrid Fault, and that maybe gas is leaking up through the fault into these homes. On Monday evening, November 12th, just a few days ago, the Rodeo Restaurant in Greenfield, Indiana, also had an explosion, followed by another house explosion Tuesday night in rural Albion. One look at these four locations on a map shows two quite obvious trends. Each of these homes is within the New Madrid Fault Zone, and the locations line up very close to a straight line north to south. Compare these locations to areas likely to be affected heavily by an impending New Madrid rupture, and you see that each one of these has fallen within the suspect area. When you add to these four mysterious explosions, two more recent explosions, which took place at Camp Minden, Louisiana, we have six mysterious explosions within a month period of time and a steady northward progression. Meanwhile, the situation at the Louisiana sinkhole spewing methane gas will not go away, and according to this official, has the potential to spread far and wide. Top official warns sinkhole could go a lot further. Potential is substantial. A lot of information has yet to come out. So if you live along the New Madrid Fault, you might want to leave a window cracked, maybe a fan on, to keep the natural gas from building up along the floor. You won't smell it if it's in the house. Natural gas is heavier than air. It will float to the bottom of the room. So one of the risks that we're talking about in this centralization of the grid, and it really touches a lot of lives. I'm sure it touches yours. You rely a lot on electricity being reliable in your neighborhood, in your home, in your life. That's why the National Electrical Reliability Corporation exists, or so they say. Of course, if you really wanted to control a nation, I guess controlling its energy source would be one way of doing that. And if you really wanted to bring a nation to its knees, the easiest way would be to attack that power source. So it's interesting that President Obama reportedly signs this really troubling piece of legislation. It's a cyber warfare policy directive. Now, as you know, we've had a couple of directives this year which were aimed at, first of all, being able to shut the web off, being able to give the executive branch, namely the President of the United States, the ability to push a button and have the internet go dark. Does he really have that ability? A lot of people say no. They say that the net is structured in such a way that it could route itself around any kind of attempt to shut it down, and people would have access to information no matter what. Others say it's not as hard as it looks. Shut down a few servers, shut down a few links, a few cell phone tower link-ups and satellite link-ups, and the whole thing goes down. Well, don't kid yourself. If Washington wants to insert itself into the free and open internet, which is now the global cyber, you know, neuronet that is allowing the human race to evolve, I think, and it's certainly allowing the human race to depose people that are oppressing here and there around the world. You have to admit that. Don't kid yourself. They want to insert themselves into it. They will, in a very serious way. The Washington Post has reported that Obama himself signed a classified cyber warfare policy directive, which is especially interesting given that the Cybersecurity Act of 2012 just failed on a 51-47 vote in the Senate, according to Silicon Valley. The Cybersecurity Act of 2012 met some early opposition among the likes of John McCain, and apparently, even with its prominent supporters, it was not able to pass. Yet, the United States government is likely not at all concerned, since Obama went ahead and signed a secret policy directive that effectively enables the military to act more aggressively to thwart cyber attacks on the nation's web of government and private computer networks, according to the Washington Post. Obviously, the most interesting and arguably alarming bit of that statement is, and private computer networks, .. This is especially interesting because the National Defense Authorization Act, the pesky NDAA, you know the one that allows them to seize you right off the street without due process of law. They don't have to charge you, and they can keep you indefinitely, and they can even deport you, and you have no right to a speedy trial. All that is gone with the National Defense Authorization Act. I think I still have the clip from Judge Napolitano. Do you remember him? He used to have a program on Fox News until, that is, he talked about the fact that the NDAA was actually a violation of the Constitution, and that we were actually going to lose our freedoms and be, well, essentially, we would be oppressed in ways that, you can't fathom. I can't find the I can't find the link here really quickly. Let's see if I can drop in here and see if I can find it. I got the story on drones. I got the skydiver. I got TARP regulations. I thought that I had the Judge Napolitano statement. I thought it was very, very powerful. And it was just interesting how Congress kind of stepped aside and let the president do this on his own. In fact, the president added some language that allowed him to, you know, deport people and take control in that manner. It was actually, the language was taken out of the bill by the Senate, and it, the language was put back into the bill by the president. And that that is according to one of the individuals that actually, you know, crafted the legislation. He said, no, we took that out, and the president put it back in. Well, this is especially interesting because this NDAA actually included an offensive cyber warfare provision, although it did not specifically state that private computer networks could be brought under government control. This was more or less just for government networks. Indeed, while the language of defense is regularly used, as it is in the above Washington Post article, one can quite easily notice that private networks would undoubtedly be placed, at least to some extent, in government hands, regardless of defense needs. Very, very frightening when it comes to rights to privacy. For those who have been paying attention, this prospect might seem especially troubling since the government can't even manage to secure the American drone fleet or U.S. command systems. Unfortunately, the Washington Post report is by no means unconfirmed and unreliable, as The Hill reported that a senior official in the Obama administration indeed confirmed that Obama already signed a directive on cyber operations. This step is part of the administration's focus on cybersecurity as a top priority. And the official said to The Hill, the cyber threat has evolved since 2004, and we have new experiences to take into account. However, the official claimed that the directive does not give any new powers to federal agencies or to the military, although we simply have to take his or her word for it since the directive itself is a secret. The directive establishes principles and processes for the use of cyber operations so that cyber tools are integrated with a full array of national security tools we have at our disposal. It provides a whole of government approach consistent with the values that we promote domestically and internationally, as we have previously articulated in the International Strategy for Cyberspace, the official said. One must wonder if Plan X, being developed by the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, you know them as DARPA, is at all related to what is being called Presidential Policy Directive 20. That sounds like something that would start Cyberdyne Systems, doesn't it? What Presidential Policy Directive 20 does, really, for the first time, is it explicitly talks about how we will use cyber operations, an anonymous senior White House official said to the Washington Post. National defense is what you're doing inside your own networks. Cyber operations is the stuff outside that space. And recognizing that you could be doing that for what might be called defensive purposes. And sometimes the best defense is a great offense. However, apparently this isn't entirely new, since according to the Post, it is an update of a 2004 presidential directive. It should, but you remember what happened in 2004, don't you? That's right, the Patriot Act. Very good. It should enable people to arrive at more effective decisions, said another unnamed senior official in the Obama administration cited by the Post. In that sense, it's an enormous step forward, Ooh, what did we hear that in the campaign? Keep moving forward, lean forward. What kind of a step forward will it be? Is this heading in a positive direction? I'd like to know your thoughts on it. What do you think? 888-429-5471. Do you think it's a good thing that the president signs a secret policy directive, Presidential Directive 20, that allows the federal government to tell an agency, whether it's a state agency, a federal agency, a local agency, like a cyber think tank or an anti-terrorist cyber team, that they can somehow seize control or, even worse, monitor everything you do, everything you say, everything you search, everything you read, everything you send to one another, everything that's posted. What if information is posted that they don't want you to know? Can they go in and remove it? Can they somehow push a button and effectively wipe out that website? Did I forget anything? Did I miss anything? Well, you make me aware of that. You can write me at bagnew@x2-radio.com, or you can always call during the live broadcast, 888-429-5471, inside North America. Everywhere else, on planet or off planet, if you can get to 530-413-9537, you can reach us right here. Now, let's talk about that third threat just a little bit. We talked about the pandemic. We talked about the cyber attacks and the physical attacks. Now let's talk about the solar EMP just a little bit. Let's talk about solar activity. I know some of you, think that sometimes things become, more of a threat or more energetic just because we're looking at it more. We're monitoring it more. It's sort of like kids with autism. It's going up and up and up every year. There probably always have been kids with autism. There have always been kids with ADD and ADHD. I mean, come on, you probably had it too when you were a kid. But you weren't diagnosed because, nobody was diagnosing. There weren't guidelines out there. No one was aware of it. No public awareness program had been out there to let people know this is what you have when you got a kid that won't sit in his chair for more than 5 minutes at a time and plays music excellently and picks up video games in minutes rather than hours, doesn't get along well with others, loves to play by himself or herself. Now they call it autism. So maybe the sun is more active or just seems to be because we're looking at it more. We have more satellites out there. We're paying closer attention to it. Maybe it's always been, noisy and unstable and vicious like a solar ocean that doesn't want to behave itself. But there are others out there, good scientists. I was going to use the word prominent, but what the heck does that mean? I mean, be serious. Are we talking about affiliated scientists or non-affiliated scientists? Affiliated means you're part of the club. You graduated from the right college. You have the right sheepskin. Your tutelage was under the right high priests of science. But that doesn't necessarily make you a good scientist. It doesn't even really make you have good aptitude. Because and I know, that the textbooks that these professors are teaching from are obsolete. In fact, the professors themselves, in most respects, are obsolete. Yes, they could teach you the historical information. They could teach you the way chemistry works or the way physics works or the way circuits work or, the way force and statics and dynamics and all of that works as a system, as a process. But who actually is the better student? Is it the homeschooled student or is it the student that's affiliated, the one that's sitting in the actual classroom with the actual professor? What do you think? 888-429-5471. Is a student that's home taught by a non-professional teacher, mom or dad or the neighbor's dad, better educated and a smarter, more inquisitive scientist than the one who goes to government schools? You tell me. You tell me. 888-429-5471. If it's that way in K through 12, if the homeschooled students consistently from K through 12 outscore those that sit in a affiliated classroom in a government school, then why can't it be so on the university level? I maintain that it is. That's my vote. That's the way I look. In fact, I think that affiliated education, whether we're talking about a city or community college, we're talking about a four-year university in your state, whether it's a state-owned university or whether it's a private university, I think, yeah, they probably got some smart people at those universities. If you take those classes and if you do well and you pass those classes, you're gonna have the material. But what if you're smarter than that? What if you're actually in the top 1% or 2% of students? What if you could pick up the same textbooks, read them, understand what you read, and then take the same tests as the students that sat in the classroom and not only pass them, but excel in them? What would you say? Would you say that the both students have the same education? I would say probably not. The one in the affiliated is going to have a classic education that's more tuned toward that affiliated system. Here's how you study. Here's how you take tests. Here's how you pass. You come to class every day. You turn your homework in, blah, 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 that kind of thing. And I would say that the self-taught or extension class or homeschooled student does get a different education, but it may, in fact, in many respects, be superior to the affiliated education. And so when you look at an individual who has a degree from, say, you know, NC State or Harvard or Yale or Johns Hopkins, and you look at an individual who has read the same textbooks, taken the same tests, passed all the same tests, and gone on to write incredibly brilliant theses and prove hypotheses and lead designs of experiment that are, you know, quite elaborate and thus successful, I would say they're both legitimate. I would say that the affiliated network is beginning to lose their franchise on higher education. Why is that? Well, because information is now accessible to everyone. Everyone can get access to the net, to the greatest library of Alexandria ever created. And I think smart people can, with that access to that information, educate themselves. And I think in many respects, because that's a cross-disciplinary education, it's not a formulated education. In other words, you take these classes and these classes only, and you'll get a degree from this college inside our university. But they're able to create the transitory relationships between sociology and music and chemistry and physics and, you know, the chart of the Euclides and the Fibonacci sequencing or other cosmological balances. All that stuff is transitory. That is to say, it transplants between one and another, and you create relationships that you probably, in fact, I would say most certainly, would not form in an affiliated education. You know that's true. I know that's true. I mean, let's be serious about it. Let's be grown up about it. So does it really matter which sheepskin is on the wall? I would maintain that it does not. I would maintain that you can be all you can be without going to the affiliated education. And so this piece that I'm going to share with you in the next hour about the sun, what's going on with the sun, what we know is happening with the sun compared to what we believe about the sun, is probably going to alarm you. It's not meant to, but if you are alarmed about it, then it's for you. You need to know this. Because there are plans that you are making or that have been handed to you by previous generations that are about to be made obsolete. The things that you are building for, that you're hoping for in the future, the future that you have been taught about or that you have been indoctrinated to believe is coming may not be coming. Now, these ideas came from non-affiliated sources and in most respects would therefore be even more legitimate than those that come from affiliated sources. I'm sorry, that's just the way I feel. I get something out of Harvard or out of MIT or out of, you know, Stanford or Berkeley. In my mind, it's scrubbed. It's been peer-reviewed and it's been scrubbed. It's been approved not to necessarily be the best statement of hypothesis, the best explanation of a thesis, but it is the least embarrassing one. Because I think at the end of the day, that's what the affiliated network is more concerned with. How are we as a university going to be embarrassed? Are we going to hurt our ability to raise money or to attract large amounts of donations or grants if we allow this kind of thesis to go out there with our school's letterhead? That's what I think it boils down to. So in the next hour, I want to talk a little bit about this solar activity, the solar condition, and maybe how it affects us, who saw it first, and should we pay attention to it. Let's do that. We'll come back right after this. Relax with a little bit of Queen. It's one of my favorite Queen songs. It's not one of the head-banging ones, but it is one that has some pretty profound words. I like it. We'll be back right after this. Don't go away.
Myself to blame, but there's something inside that's turning my mind away. Oh, I could love you if I could let you stay.
Yeah.
maybe it is too late. I don't know, but maybe it's not too late. That's a great song by Queen. I really enjoy it. It's late. It's my favorite because it's just so powerful. Not just about love, but about you know, maybe the way we live our lives. Do we live it right? Are we living the right way, or are we wasting our time? I think many of you do feel like we are. Somebody is wasting their time, and they need to get out of your way, don't they? This is Brooks Agnew, third hour of X Squared Radio. Our IQ window forecast, 51 degrees outside. It's going to get down pretty chilly tonight, but it's going to be a nice day tomorrow. So Thanksgiving week for most people. Next Sunday, we will most likely run an archive because I will be on the road coming back from central Kentucky from visiting grandkids. Before I get into this stuff about the sun, I want to see if I can put you in a little bit better financial position, or at least a better financial perspective. By the way, don't forget about the food investor, okay? Go to X Squared Radio at x2-radio.com. Right at the top on the right-hand side is the banner for the food investor. Get your 72-hour kit together. This is going to be a pretty harsh winter, and you never know what's going to happen with the way the grid is so sensitive to everything now. If the power goes out, you need to be able to feed yourself and provide yourself water for 3 days. You might as well pick up something that's going to keep for 30 years and doesn't have any preservatives in it. The food investor. Now, one of the things that happened when the Revolutionary War took place, we had smart people that tried to establish a good government for us. There are two things that primarily they wanted to get away from. The first, of course, was the linking of religion with the national government, so that there's no like national church like there was the Church of England. There's no national church like there is in Islam, where you have Sharia law or whatever. And so we separated the church and the state on purpose, so that there was no official religion. The second was perhaps even more important, and that was separating the idea that a private bank would print the money for the country. They had lots of examples of that already happening throughout history. And wise people, Franklin and Jefferson, made the case that a central bank, a national bank that could control not only the issuing and printing of the currency, but the value of the currency, would be the death of any nation. And with the dark and nefarious formation of the Federal Reserve in 1908, we saw this terrible control settled over a nation that was formed specifically to get away from that. We fought a war over this. We fought on the sea, we fought on the land, and if we could have in that time, we would have fought in the air with all of our hearts for independence from that kind of rule. And yet, they followed us. The Rothschilds and the Morgans and et cetera, they followed us. And in the dark of night, in a secret meeting on an island, Woodrow Wilson signed into law the Federal Reserve Act. Over the years, Congress has completely abdicated its constitutional duty to mint money. That is now done by the Federal Reserve, which is a private bank. Now, of late, it is no secret that because the Federal Reserve is not only able to print the money, but they're also able to, you know, loan the money or borrow the money from the government at 0% interest and then loan the money back to the government at interest, you create an automatic system of perpetually increasing debt. And you know, and I know, debt is slavery. This is exactly what the Founding Fathers wanted to avoid, and we did it. We walked straight into it. But what happens is you reach a mathematical end game, and the Federal Reserve has an end game for the dollar. Listen closely. With a second round of what they call quantitative easing, it's called QE, underway, the U.S. Federal Reserve, and just take the U.S. off of there, the Federal Reserve wants us to believe that it is doing its duty as the nation's central bank. Remember, I told you we fought one hell of a bloody war over this, and we won. The blue coats won the war, but the bankers followed us anyway, and they got us. In the dark of night, they bought a president, Woodrow Wilson. Is there anyone anywhere on this planet that doubts our current presidency has been bought and that they are currently signing legislation, law, into place that is serving a master? They believe they're doing their duty, promoting maximum employment, keeping a lid on inflation, and making sure that long-term interest rates remain at reasonable levels. This is known as the Fed's dual mandate, since the inflation and interest rate objectives are really the same goal. But here's the shocker. The Federal Reserve's real dual mandate is to enrich the banks. The central bank is created by and works for, and to cover Congress when its laws enrich banks at the expense of jobless American taxpayers. Understanding how quantitative easing works is simple. It is so simple. Understanding how banks and Congress are manipulating this economic tool is just a tad more complicated. Understanding how quantitative easing will impact your life is exactly what I want to do in the next 5 minutes. The mechanics of quantitative easing are straightforward. For instance, the Federal Reserve can decide to lower interest rates for any number of reasons, to curb inflation, encourage buying, but it's usually to encourage borrowing and consumption to stimulate the economy. Go out and lay down the plastic, people. Go get a loan. Come on, go back to the mall. When the Fed decides to lower rates, it does so by reducing the so-called Fed funds rate, the bank rates. These are the rates banks charge each other for overnight loans, sort of like a credit window. Now, there's no real business done at night, but what the banks do is they borrow the money and then trade currencies while the bank's closed. They do it 30, 40, 50 times a month. Micro trades. Each trade only makes a fraction of a percentage of interest. But, of course, cumulatively, it turns out to be 30, 40, up to 60% a year. Now, the Fed doesn't just say what it wants the Fed funds rate to be. Through what's known as open market operations, the Fed actually lowers the rate to its target by purchasing U.S. Treasury securities from banks. The cash the banks receive in return can then be lent out. And when a lot of banks have money to lend, there's usually a general decline in the overall interest, overall level of interest rates in the broader marketplace because they want to get the money back into circulation. Right now, because the Fed keeps purchasing short-term government securities, you remember Clinton taking a lot of long-term stuff to short-term, the Fed funds rate is at roughly 0%. I mean 0.0% to about 0.25%. This time around, however, low marketplace interest rates haven't been enough to stimulate the economy and generate reasonable growth. That's because you're already as low as you can get. It's not like we're going from 18% in Jimmy Carter days back down to 8 or 9% to get the economy moving again. We are at zero. I mean, the only way to get any lower is to pay people to borrow money, okay? Regardless of what you call it, the maneuver simply means the central bank is buying still more government securities. That's what quantitative easing is. So what's happening is the government is borrowing all the available money. There's nothing left. Picture it this way. You got six billionaires at a card table, and they're playing cards. Now, obviously, the game can go on for a while because there's a lot of money at that table. But sooner or later, sometime around now, nobody at the table can ante up. Well, they look around at each other and say, wait a minute, I didn't leave the table. You didn't leave the table. What's going on? There should be one hell of a pile of chips on this table somewhere in front of somebody. There's got to be a winner, right? We're playing cards. Well, there isn't, because all the money is gone. All the money is in the hands of the banks. They got it all. And because it's governments that are borrowing it by the trillions, I mean by the hundreds of billions every month, and the Fed, in order to keep the dollar from collapsing, is printing, when it really should be Congress, the Fed is now printing between $40 and $80 billion more money per month to keep the dollar from collapsing. So there's really a four-step process here. The dealers and big institutional buyers of treasuries all know the schedule of when the U.S. Treasury auctions new bills, notes, bonds. Step two, they drive down the price of issues coming to auction by shorting enough of existing securities whose maturity they know is coming to market, and then customers are standing aside and waiting to buy later. Step three, since the dealers have lowered the price and raised the yield on existing securities, market buyers put in offers to buy from the Treasury close to the lowered price for the new securities. And now you see the process. Step four. Once the new issues are bought at lowered prices, dealers and customers bid them up high enough so that when the Fed comes in, under its announced schedule of quantitative easing purchases to buy different maturity securities, the dealers sell back the now inflated bonds held by them and their customers, netting a tidy profit in the process, taking zero risk. And who's paying these higher prices and providing the windfall to the banks? We are. Exactly right. That's what's happening. Now, there are only two ways that you can protect yourself as a consumer right now for doing this. Number one is take your money out of the bank. Take your money out of the bank. Sell your 401k. Pay the 10% penalty. Take your money out of the bank and put it in your own possession. And the second is to convert the cash into precious metals, silver and gold and platinum and palladium and rhodium. If you convert it into precious metals, you are now hedged against this inflation. Because when the dollar collapses, my friends, it collapses. And that means you can have a wheelbarrow full of money and it won't buy anything because it's going to be worthless. So that's your way out. Now, I buy my silver from APMEX, APMEX.com. No, I'm not an affiliate of theirs. I don't make a dime off of that. I'm just telling you that's who I buy my metal from. There are other sellers of metal. You can buy junk coins. You can buy gold jewelry. But transfer your cash into metal and do it as quickly as you can. And I cashed in my 401k, sold it, paid the 10% hit, got out of debt. Personally, done. I haven't been in debt in almost 10 years. Do the same thing. Because when this goes down, it's going to take every taxpayer that's in debt with a credit card with them. All right. Now, let's talk about this solar thing. Before I do that, let's see if we can get an update from L.A. Roland, can you say what you got to say in a couple minutes? I got a long piece here to go. What's up?
Sure. I was listening to your comments on the silver and gold. I think I agree. Here's a question I have for that, though. If your money is invested in stocks, is it safe or no?
No, absolutely not. The stock market is undergoing a slow, steady correction right now. It's already dropped 600 points last week. That's nothing. I'm looking for a drop between 2,000 and 3,000 points by the end of the year, and I doubt it will stop there.
We're heading over that cliff.
Well, it's not really a cliff. It's more of a hill. Because what's happening is the Fed is printing money as fast as the ink will dry. So they're trying to head it off, but it's going to run out. And two things have happened. First, Germany is making a very serious move to relocate their gold from the vaults in New York and in the United States back to Europe. They want their gold. They want it in their possession in Europe. The second thing that's going to happen is France, Spain, and Italy cannot fail. They will not be allowed to fail. They have too much hard value in their system. And the third thing that's going to happen, believe it or not, Japan is now 326% in debt. We're about 125% in debt compared to our GDP. Japan is already over the cliff. Already over. It's done. Forking them. They're finished.
So are we going to back up Japan?
Well, you got to remember that Japan has a lot of earning power because of Toyota and all the Japanese manufacturers, but nobody's buying. Why is nobody buying? Because the banks aren't loaning. The reason they're not loaning is because governments have borrowed up all the money. There's nothing left to borrow. The bank, the central bank, we have reached the end. We have reached the end. They've charged all the interest that they can possibly charge. They've printed all the money they can possibly print. And the same thing that happened in 1908 and 1929 is going to happen again. There's no way around.
I've been trying to tell people that for 12 years, and no one believes it.
It has to happen. If you look at the graphs and you look at where silver and gold have come, and right now silver is horribly, horribly artificially depressed because Morgan Stanley is both shorting the silver and they're long on the silver, and there are many who have told me recently and really have the inside information that Morgan Stanley might not actually be long on silver, which means they might not actually have the silver in their vaults. They're pretending they're long on silver, but they have 30 million short contracts out there on the same metal.
Wow.
Yeah, they can't let silver go up in price because if they do, Morgan Stanley will fail.
Yep. So if they let it go long, they're a mess.
Well, if they let the price go up, they're a mess because they got to start making all those short contracts. And you know what will happen is the government will step in and say, Morgan Stanley's too big to fail. No, you don't have to make these margin calls. And when they do, it's going to collapse. It's called maintaining a market. And can't do it. You get nailed for it, and it's going to destabilize, and you'll go down. You can't.
Well, I mean, I'm sure you're aware of all the news about Hostess closing and the 18,000 employees being gone that are going to get laid off. And I'm sure you're aware of all that. Here's the one thing. The Antelope Valley Press in Lancaster, California, had this in their paper last night. It said that Sacramento needs to ease up on taxes, ease up on regulations, and be better run. Well, that's kind of the truth for everything, isn't it?
Well, you know, it's one thing to say ease up on the regulations because then people will say, oh, yeah, but that'll make dirty air and dirty water people be unsafe. Cars will be unsafe and water will be unsafe and blah, blah, blah. Not all the regulations are in place for safety. A lot of the regulations are in place to protect businesses that are in bed with government, either by lobbyists or big campaign contributions. It's all about protectionism. And the Environmental Protectionist Agency is the key culprit. And they are set up with a set of, I'm going to call them long knives. They're ready to go after the coal industry and kill it. They've got enough regulations in the breach right now that if they fired the gun, the coal industry in the United States would be broke. Done.
Why aren't they going to stop sales of coal back there?
Well, that's a really good question, and I don't know the answer to it. I suspect, but I just can't say. I don't know. I can't believe that they care so much about the CO2 content in our atmosphere that they think coal is so nefarious, even the liquid coal technology, which our friends in Alaska have perfected, is polluting, when it's not. It's not adding any more CO2 to the air than we already have, either from natural gas or other sources. For some reason, coal is being targeted for elimination.
I know, and that's really odd, because that basically was the Industrial Revolution of this country. They're fired up to it.
Yep. Well, there's more to come. I need this half hour, Roland. I got to talk about the solar instabilities.
One nice music thing. There's a gentleman named Brian, B-R-I-A-N, Auger, A-U-G-E-R. He had a band called the Blooming Express. Anyway, he was nice enough on Friday night to sign it to my friend Nietzsche. He's a great guy. He's from England. But he lives here in Los Angeles, and they're excellent music. It's jazz and it's fusion.
Cool. Cool. Well, when we have more time, we'll talk about it. I'm going to jump into this segment now. I really appreciate the call. Thanks so much for your energy, Roland. All right. I know you know who Pane Androv is. I mean, Androv, he's a great researcher. He is a great physicist. He thinks a little bit outside the box. I know you've heard of Paul LaViolette. You know, some of you love him, some of you hate him. Yeah, I understand. But there are some interesting things going on with the sun. And I want you to be made aware of them. You know, the engine which drives the rotation and shape of each galaxy, I've often called it a supermassive spinning black hole, which I did in the Arc of Millions of Years series. He does too, and now a lot of mainstream scientists are learning what we already knew. How did we know it? Well, honestly, we went through ancient records. We went through Maya. We went through the Kabbalah. We went through the Sefer Yetzirah. We went through the Popol Vuh. We used over 40 ancient texts and civilizations to back up our idea that there was a supermassive spinning black hole in the center of every galaxy. We did this back in 2004. Now we have the Hubble Space Telescope. There's a lot of information out on it. We've done a lot of studies on star velocities and gravitational velocities inside and outside the galaxies and superclusters of galaxies, and we're pretty much convinced that it is. Now, today we know that these supermassive spinning black holes are actually spinning at their maximum rates. Absolutely unbelievable. Some of them at 3,000 times a second. That's a lot, especially considering their overwhelming mass. At this spin rate, they create a plane of gravity, which we call the galactic plane. Coincidentally enough, spiral galaxies like our own distribute stars and planets that revolve around those stars, and planets that are free-floating along that galactic plane. And they bob up and down in pretty regular, you know, points. Our solar system is about ready to line up with that plane. As we go through it, you already know from reading our books and from listening to many guests, which we've had on this program, talk about it, that there are some effects that are going to take place. Not just cosmological effects. Some of them are going to be planetary, some of them are going to be solar, and some of them are going to be consciousness. Now, the important thing to know about these is that they go through these cycles, these supermassive spinning black holes that last for many thousands of years, and at the end of each cycle, they explode, okay? And from the point of singularity, they release powerful and for humankind still unknown forms of energy. You've heard me talk about, going all the way back to 2005 on Coast to Coast with George Norrie, that I didn't really buy into the fact that there was a single Big Bang. In fact, in my book, Remembering the Future, the Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, I have a chapter saying the Big Bang never happened. There's an increasingly, a growing school of thought that the universe undergoes a series or a sequence of medium bangs all the time. That's when these supermassive spinning black holes actually go through some Higgs event and they blow up. Now, it is so powerful, this form of energy, that it affects the DNA of life, the whole energetic makeup of the galaxy, and usually stretches to the very distant corners of that galaxy and beyond that galaxy, out into the distances between galaxies. It appears to be completely intelligent and, like the point of singularity, possesses unusual properties. In other words, we can see it as a scanning program of the cosmic designer himself. I don't know how to put it any other way to you. You can accept that or not accept it, but energy is information. And this information appears to be not only well organized, but it appears to be targeted to resonate with the human DNA. Let me put it another way. You know, the DNA of any human being is influenced by its immediate environment. What you eat, what you drink, the stress that you put yourself on, the soul that's inside the body that coexists inside that, you can call it a soul carrier, I call it a biological transducer. It's been called all kinds of things. This hunk of meat filled with water that we animate with our soul. That interaction goes on our entire lives, and it's passed on as we affect our DNA, and our seed comes together, male and female, and our children grow. And so generation after generation, we have a continuous forward-looking effect of this environment interacting with the DNA. Well, now, because the solar system is getting very close to this galactic plane, that DNA is beginning to resonate with the spirit that's inside the biological transducer and the DNA. So you kind of have a spiritual DNA and a physical DNA, and they're both being affected by this. If it resonates with it, if it doesn't resonate with it, it's just going to be wiped out. It's just going to go into another state. But if it does resonate with it, it's going to upgrade. Now, not long ago, thanks to new surveillance technologies, this is real stuff, real science. We're not talking about remote viewing. We're not talking about dreaming. We're not talking about channeling. Real surveillance technology that we launched into space. It was confirmed that something extraordinary definitely happened within the galactic core of the Milky Way. The images and the video data clearly showed cosmic jets coming from the galactic core. That means this event has already happened. The analysis of the data also confirmed a powerful release of an enormous amount of energy, which is a huge shining circular wave, and it's spreading across the galaxy from its center to its edges. For those of you that haven't been outside the Milky Way galaxy lately, our little main sequence sun, sits on the edge of the Milky Way galaxy. In other words, that pulse, that enormous amount of energy, intelligent energy, is headed our way. The released energetic pulse is already affecting the entire galaxy, including including our solar system, our sun. Now, in 1999, NASA launched a satellite, the Chandra X-ray Observatory, that is capable of scanning space with X-rays, and much of what was previously invisible and unimaginable to the human eye has now become visible. Chandra managed to record the cosmic jet that was ejected from the supermassive black hole in the center of the Milky Way, together with huge and powerful energetic wave that is spreading along the galactic plane. We're lining up with that plane right now, this month. The images provided by Chandra were mind-blowing, and those in the know were scratching their heads what exactly they are looking at and what it means for our planet. There are a few online articles, yes, out there, but we don't really have a lot of information about what this absolutely is. But absolutely no data was provided what exactly this discovery means for us, and will it affect our solar system. The articles were written in a way that usual, impression of the reader would be, nothing to worry about. It's billions of years from now. Nothing's going to happen during our lifetime or the lifetime of our grandchildren. Listen closely. For those of you who really understand advanced astrophysics, who can think out of the box, after reading those articles, it becomes obvious that this discovery is of tremendous importance to us, that it requires a lot more attention and further scientific study, and it is something to be concerned about. The forecast is that the same thing that we have seen happen to other suns, okay, major changes, swelling in size, and then ejecting the outer layer and becoming much smaller. We call it the life cycle of a sun or a star. Of course, if you contact NASA, they'll deny all of this, exactly the same as their approach about UFO, ET question. The forecast is it is going to happen. As soon as this extremely powerful energetic pulse makes a contact, and it will not be in 5 billion years, it won't be in 100,000 years, it won't be in 1 year, it will be on December 23rd of this year. A complex nuclear reaction will be set in motion that will cause our sun to begin increasing in size. We already know what that means. We've seen it happen with other stars. Those of you that can search your memories, you'll know what I'm talking about. You'll know exactly what I'm talking about. Usually, this is something that we put off, a long time. We don't even think about it. We cover it in class and it's very good and goes away. But that means that this swelling of the sun, it will come extremely close to Earth, causing impossible conditions for biological life with daily temperatures ranging above 2,000 degrees C. I don't know if you know how high that temperature is, but this is a temperature above what we would call calcination. It's a very intense temperature. Usually, this is the point where most of you will raise the red flag, thinking there's no way this can happen, it can't be accurate, but I encourage you to continue to study this. We're going to cover it more as time goes forward in more detail, because it's important. NASA's Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope was launched on the 11th of June 2008, and its importance is that it provided unbreakable proof that the galactic core of the Milky Way galaxy did explode in the distant past, resulting with detectable, powerful cosmic jet perpendicular with the galactic plane and is spreading pulse of energy that travels along the galactic plane toward the edges of the galaxy. The galaxy is about, 125 light years across, something like that. Or it's 125,000 light years across. So Some people are saying they can already feel this energy. I wouldn't be the least surprised. Some people, you know, I have a listener right now, Christopher Holden, who's telling me he can feel it going up his spine on a daily basis. This is why TPTB are building underground facilities. I was going to mention that if you don't think that governments know something is coming, look what they're spending their money on. They're building tunnels, underground bases. They're stocking food. They're stocking water. They're getting their favorite rooms already. They've got underground forests and gardens and everything with glow lights and nuclear power sources to power these things for years. They've got all this set up. What? You didn't get your invitation? You didn't get your ticket? Well, don't feel like the Lone Ranger. I didn't either. And you've often heard me on this program, it's time that they just go ahead and get in those facilities now. Go ahead, beat the rush. Take off from here. Go ahead and lock the door. Get in there, and we'll take it from here. Well, using data from NASA's Fermi, scientists have recently discovered a gigantic, mysterious structure in the Milky Way galaxy. The feature looks like a pair of bubbles extending above and below our galaxy center. Each detected lobe is about 25,000 light years tall, which means the whole feature spans 50,000 light years above and below the center of the galaxy, kind of like balloons blown up above the center of the plate, which we call the Milky Way galaxy. It clearly shows an eruption from a supersized black hole at the center of our galaxy. The wave is on the way. It was discovered. It's been measured, it's been photographed, it's been looked at. This dumbbell-shaped feature above and below the galactic center extends 50 degrees north and south from the plane of the Milky Way, spanning the sky from the constellation Virgo to the constellation Grus. After processing the data, enormous energy was detected in the galactic plane, and by enormous, scientists mean enormous. Now, if the sun begins to swell on December 23rd of this year, a lot of people are wondering how long will it take before this thing gets large enough that it overtakes Mercury, it overtakes Venus, it overtakes Earth. How long is it going to be? Well, some scientists say it'll be 100,000 years before anything happens. Others are saying 6 years, maybe less. HESS is the High Energy Stereoscopic System, and it represents a multi-year construction effort by an international team of more than 100 scientists and engineers. These are not crackpots. These are engineers that put together the biggest, most accurate, most precise radio telescope in the world. It's a system of four 52-foot diameter telescopes. It's currently among the most sensitive detectors of very high-energy gamma rays. These are absorbed in the atmosphere where they give a short-lived shower of particles. The HESS telescopes detect these faint, short flashes of bluish light when these particles emit what's called Cherenkov light, lasting a few billionths of a second. This is what happens when gamma rays hit air molecules. Each image gives the position on the sky of a single gamma ray photon. A photon is a specific wavelength of light that is emitted when an electron is sputtered off of a molecule in the atmosphere. When an electron is sputtered off, another electron falls in to take its place. That fall creates a photon. And the amount of light collected gives the energy of the initial gamma ray. That's how we detect it. It's through a fluorescing action. We call it gamma ray fluorescence. Now, building up the images photon by photon allows HESS to create maps of astronomical objects as they appear in gamma ray form. We're not looking for visible light. We're not looking for sound. We're looking for the X-rays that it gives off when it's in these high-energy states. Now, the real surprise came when the Hess telescope system data showed that the density of cosmic rays exceeds that in the solar neighborhood by a significant factor, by a whole lot. Interestingly, this difference increases as we go up in energy, which implies that the cosmic rays have been recently accelerated. They haven't decayed. They haven't been attrited by attenuation of space. It's new. So this data hints that the clouds are illuminated by a nearby cosmic ray accelerator, which was active over the last 26,000 years. Interestingly, this streams in parallel with what was found as evidence in the ice core records in the Antarctica and in Greenland. We didn't know why we saw those energy spikes. Now we do. The only realistic candidate for such acceleration site is the supermassive spinning black hole at the center of the galaxy. That's it. It's the only thing that can line up, and it's conclusive. Even bigger surprise comes when our sun started to behave strangely and being almost without sunspots for 2 full years. We haven't seen that before. The low solar wind caused weakness in the solar system's heliosphere that resulted with the collapse of Earth's thermosphere. The world had witnessed electromagnetic currents moving in the upper atmosphere where they should not exist. At high levels of intelligence, secret meetings were conducted, and the main theme was the newborn situation and how will all that influence power grids and the whole life of Earth. That's why we spoke about it in the second hour. That's why the NERC is so excited and excitable, and they're spending so much money to try to get a hold of the grid and centrally control it and protect it. Yes, cyber attacks and physical attacks, and yes, pandemic, but this EMP, this electromagnetic pulse, this geomagnetic storm that has already knocked our grid out once, it would have in 1859 if we had a grid. We only had, you know, telegraph then, but it still knocked it out. Funny thing was that after 400 years of observation, just when we thought we were starting to understand the most complex dynamics of our star, we have great satellites watching it, our sun had showed us that this is not the case by doing something we have never observed before. It went extremely quiet and blank without sunspots during 2008 and 2009, part of 2010, resulting with the collapse of our planet's rarefied layer of gas called the thermosphere. We have never seen the sun go so quiet before. I told you over and over again, almost every Sunday for 2 years, this is the calm before the storm. We have never seen the puzzling collapse of the thermosphere high above Earth's surface where the atmosphere meets space. It further resulted with deviations of Earth's magnetic field and creating major openings in the Earth's magnetosphere. We have never seen those before. The same anomalies are still appearing, and the statistics are showing that the anomalies are not stopping. They are increasing, and the rate of increase is increasing. Back in 2008, the only logical thing to do was to search for a clue why our star and the solar system and the whole thing, extreme experience, before unseen changes on every level. The only thing we could do is launch another satellite, which we did. We put the SDO up there, a stereographic satellite, to take a closer look. What's going on? SOHO wasn't telling us what we needed to know. The conclusion was to scan for some disturbance close to our solar system, outside the solar system, and to discover, is there any interaction between our solar system and interstellar space? And was something detected when we went out there and looked? And the answer is yes, and it was recent. There was something major detected at the edge of our solar system, or to be more specific, in the region where the galactic equator is positioned. Believe it or not, the big yes, the big aha, came from low-cost NASA spacecraft known as IBEX. The Interstellar Boundary Explorer launched in space on October 19th, 2008. The real shocker began when the people in the know, when IBEX discovered a giant ribbon of magnetics at the edge of a solar system. It is about 30 light years wide, and it contains a wispy mixture of hydrogen and helium atoms at a temperature of more than a million degrees C, and it is highly magnetized. This giant ribbon of magnetics is powerful enough to energize our sun and cause our star to move from its main sequence position to its red giant phase. What that means is that the sun is going to increase in size, and although it's going to be cooler, the cloud is going to be hotter. And that cloud is going to expand to a point where it consumes Mercury, it consumes Venus, and it will push Earth into a longer orbit. In other words, we're going to be moved away from the sun by the shockwave. We don't know exactly how it's going to happen. We do know exactly when it's going to begin. It's going to begin on December 23rd of this year. Does that mean the end of humanity? Possibly. Does it mean we need to start planet hopping further out into space? We need to look for another solar system? Possibly. But settled in behind our sun, on the other side of the sun from us, is another star. Yes, many scientists already agree. If you look at the conservation of momentum, there is a binary star that is close to beginning to shake hands with our sun. What will happen when this sun goes out is the two will begin coalescing. We already have witnessed it many times in space. We use our radio telescopes to measure it and detect it. We use the laser interferometer gravitational wave observatories, the two LIGOs, one in Hanover, Washington, and the other in Livingston, Louisiana. And we have measured these very carefully. We verified that coalescing neutron stars are out there. And when they spin around each other, they actually ripple spacetime. But when these two stars come back together, they will form a new star. And the solar system will begin again. Which means the solar system is born again. So I'm trying to tell you to energetically, consciously get ready for this. Be aware of it. If you're not aware of it, I want you to go read Pane Androv's work. He is the chief editor of Nexus Magazine. I can tell you right now that this research is as good as it gets out there. There is no better research. This is the leading edge of the leading edge. We've been talking about it for a long time on this program, giving you little bits and pieces of information over that period of time. It is now coalesced. It has come together. And I can tell you, this is the most important work that's being done on the planet today. I want you to pay close attention. Although this magnetic ribbon looks bright in the IBEX map, it does not glow in any conventional sense. It's not like something you'd see on Star Trek, you know, whipping across space. The ribbon is not a source of light, visible light, but it's rather a source of particles, sort of like gravel, energetic neutral atoms, or what's called ENAs. IBEX's sensors can detect these particles, which are produced in the outer heliosphere. The heliosphere is the very, very outside of the solar wind. It's as far as it blows out into space before it's overcome by the galactic wind, the one that's coming out of the center of the galaxy is a steady flow. Every 6 months, NASA receives an update from IBEX. when scientists had finished assembling a second complete sweep around the sky, IBEX has again delivered an unexpected result. The map has changed significantly. That means we can't look at the universe in a humanistic way. The forces that have worked on our planet are the same forces that have always worked on it, and so we can extrapolate back into time. That is out the window. The catastrophism that we put forth in our books, 1,500 pages worth, is what you should use as your basis of science. The new observations showed that the interaction of the sun with the interstellar medium is far more dynamic and variable than anybody could have envisioned. The Maya did, and the Sumerians did, and the Popol Vuh did, and the Sefer Yetzirah did. So where did they get their information? The interest of this enormous interaction at the edge of our solar system became huge. So in order to keep the general public from seeing what is truly happening, they came up with a story that the magnetic ribbon is simply a reflection. That story is very interesting because it does not explain why Voyager spacecrafts and Cassini were not seeing this reflection before. They didn't see it before because it wasn't there before. There was nothing there. It suddenly appeared. You'll remember, Voyager crafts are now outside the heliosphere. They didn't see it. They've been traveling out there for decades, and they didn't see it. In reality, it was a cover story. Another 6 months passed. IBEX update was never published, or no one in the public domain saw the data. It was totally secret. But we already have all that we need. If we know what to look for and know where to look, I guess you must have got the message. We're still facing this mega event at the end of this year. Perhaps some of you would think, if this is a wave of energy, if it's real, what does it mean that all the stars in the Milky Way galaxy were energetic pulses that already passed? What's going to happen? Is this the case? The answer is yes. Go online, do some research for yourself on red giants and super giants, and you'll see what I'm saying. We'll talk about this more, not next week because I'm going to run an archive, but the following week, we'll be in December by then, the following week, we will have more information for you. It's interesting to mention that some people contact Mr. Androff with the statement that if this spreading wave from Sagittarius A is real, it should reach us a lot sooner, not in December 2012, because it should travel at the speed of light. Well, for the record, it takes 2 seconds for light to arrive from the moon, 8 minutes for the light to reach us from the sun, and about 45 minutes from Jupiter. It's all good. But the closer concentric circles are to the disturbance, the more powerful they are and very fast. The further they travel from the source, they start to lose on power and speed, and at the end, they stop. Well, the same as in space. We're about 26,000 light years away from the galactic center. When the galactic core explosion took place around 26,000 years ago, the spreading wave was very fast, traveling at the speed of light. After traveling 15,000, it started to slow down, etc. And now it is detected by IBEX in less than 10 billion miles from us. Okay? It's getting closer every day. It is obviously traveling at a lot less than the speed of light. But it's still very fast. And we're not talking about waves here. We're not talking about frequencies. We're talking about energetic particles. It is obviously traveling at less than the speed of light. It has slowed down. And that's why it isn't going to reach us until the 23rd of December. Who knew that the Maya would be off by 2 days? Okay? It's coming. Get yourself ready. There's definitely a consciousness involved in this. And we'll talk about that very, very much in the next 2 weeks. If you have any questions about this, you can write me, bagnew@x2-radio.com. I will be happy to send you to the website where this information is available. bagnew@x2-radio.com. We'll see you in 2 weeks, right here on X Squared Radio. We love you. Love you. Love one another. Help each other to grow a little bit every day, and before long, you will have saved the planet.